Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Out with the old and in with the new, that's one way to go. But for some, the past is worth preserving, especially the historic buildings that populate Columbus and the Central Ohio region. The Columbus Landmarks Foundation has again released its top 10 list of endangered buildings. The list includes the Ohio National Bank building in downtown Columbus and what's left of Cooper Stadium. Joining us now is Executive Director of the Columbus Landmarks Foundation, Ed Lentz. Welcome back.
Always a pleasure, Ann.
You know, listeners, coming up, we're going to be talking about what you can do if you're in an old build. If you have an older building you're trying to preserve, how to do that, what are the best practices. We'll be doing that coming up. So if you have a question or comment later on in the program, give us a call at 614-292-8513. Ed, this is the third year for the list, right?
Fourth, actually.
Fourth year, okay. Mm-hmm. Why did Columbus Landmarks Foundation start this 4 years ago?
We did it basically to follow the lead. We're not unique in this regard. There are some of these lists, like the National Endangered Buildings List, has been around now for about 30 years. And we've been looking at it for a while, but we got to the point where our advocacy committee at Landmarks has gotten to the point where we'd said, it's time to bring a list like this forward here in Columbus as well. What it does is bring public attention to buildings that we feel are in some clear and present danger of imminent destruction of one kind or another, or imminent change. And we were trying to preserve the best of Columbus while looking to good new design as well. And what this list does is help bring to public attention some of these kind of structures that you may not have been aware of. You may not have thought about all that much.
What qualifies to make the top 10?
What qualifies essentially is how much danger is this building in. One of the things we've come up with this year that sort of helps differentiate this a little bit is something called our watch list. You may have a building that you think may have some problems down the road, it may have some threat down the road, but at the moment it's just fine. But we want to keep an eye on it. Well, that list is new, our watch list. With the endangered list, there is some clear threat of one kind or another. Could be governmental, could be private, could be Mother Nature, for that matter, you name it. Any of these kind of things. We have a list that comes forth. Public sends us all kinds of information about buildings that they think are perhaps eligible for the list. Our advocacy committee sits around and over a period of a couple of months before our annual meeting sort of boils the list down to our top choices. And there is no set number. If you take a look at our old lists, occasionally it's 13 buildings, okay. And then it'll be 12, and this year it's 10. It may include some from previous lists, mm-hmm. Okay, but it may include some new ones as well. And you'll find that some of the buildings that had once been on the list maybe have now moved down, for example, from endangered to just watch. Okay.
Can you give me an example of that?
Classic example is the Port Columbus Terminal, which is the first air passenger terminal in America when Transcontinental Air Transport built it in 1929. The airport had left that building vacant for some considerable period of time. It had roof problems. It had mold. It was in really, really pretty bad shape. But the airport had made the decision that they're not going to tear it down, but they'll be willing to let the building sit there for a while if we can find a developer or some other set of public and private partners to bring the building back. Well, what happened was a separate committee, it wasn't Landmarks, it was another whole committee, came forth with a plan to try to at least stabilize the building. And over the course of the last couple of years, they raised about $100,000 and were very successful in stabilizing the building. They put a new roof on it, took the mold out of it, and now the building is a nice structural shell. The airport has continued to say, we're not going to demolish this building anytime soon. And if people want to come forward and make a deal, we'll talk to them. So what that means is the building is not now in clear and present danger.
It's not deteriorating.
So we moved it from endangered down to watch. Okay.
Because there is still no future for it.
Because nobody has come forward and said, right. I'm going to develop this building tomorrow morning.
You know, that's such an unusual structure, and we're going to get to Cooper Stadium in a few minutes. But what do you do with something that's unusual? It's in a location that's not, you know, great. It's out by the airport.
Well,
who goes there? People who are coming and going.
Well, for a considerable number of years, in fact, the airport did indeed lease that building out as office space.
Oh, okay.
And it was only within the last decade or so that the building has been vacant. But the airport itself was leasing it. And it doesn't have ample parking, but it's got some parking, 8-10 cars, right next to it. So if you had – it has a development opportunity. And one of the things we were hopeful about was a local bank back about a year ago had announced that they were going to try to look forward to redeveloping that whole site, not just the terminal but also hangar number one, which is across the way about, 50 to 100 yards away from the terminal itself. That deal did not go forward. After analyzing it and running the numbers, they decided that they really couldn't do that deal, so they backed off, which was too bad because that would have made – that bank headquarters would have made a wonderful use for that entire property. So it's not beyond the realm of possibility that some other group of public or private partners may come forward and do something with that terminal. So it's not in imminent danger
at
this point.
Is there any obligation on the part of the airport at this point because of the $100,000 that was raised to stabilize the structure? Mm-hmm. Is there any obligation legal on the part of the airport to to sell the land and keep the structure intact? In other words, could they just sell it and let somebody else tear it apart?
The short answer is no.
Okay.
is the short answer, because one of the problems that the airport faces is from a national level, there are federal requirements that the airport continue to use that property in some manner related to the use of it. In other words, they can't completely divest themselves of it.
Okay.
And I'm not enough of an expert on federal aircraft regulation to tell you why or how that works. But that's what part of their claim is. They claim that they don't necessarily have to do anything with the building, but they can't really dispose of the property and forget it and walk away.
Okay.
So that's why they're still linked to it. Okay? At least that's my understanding, a layman's understanding. I would say to get the full understanding on that, you need to talk with folks out of Port Columbus.
A lot of people were excited. A lot of people were excited for the wrong reasons, but be that as it may, over the plan to convert Cooper Stadium into an auto racing facility,
right,
and research institute kind of a thing.
Sure.
And that stalled, and nobody from Arshot, the company that was looking to remake Cooper Stadium into a racing facility, is responding to calls for interviews or anything like that. But that probably was taken off the danger list at one point, right?
Yeah.
Or would have been because of that. But now nothing's happened, and now who knows?
Right. And so now it's sort of moved back up because it is not it seems to have a little more clear and present danger associated with it, because the longer you let something like that wait without a clear definition of where it's going or what it's doing, which is what we have at the airport, then you begin to wonder, hey, we ought to bring some attention back to this. Maybe people ought to start thinking about it again, about what we want to do out there and why. And again, the purpose of the list is to raise community attention to that particular issue. If the Schottenstein partners are having trouble putting together the deal they want on the site, that's perhaps the issue, but we don't know. And so because we don't know, we're going to move it up a little bit, a notch on the list.
They wanted to convert Cooper Stadium. I mean, ostensibly, whoever buys that property or owns it could just tear down Cooper Stadium. There's no law preventing that, is there?
No, not necessarily. They could go ahead and go forward with that.
What makes Cooper Stadium distinctive and important?
Oh, essentially, its long history. And in fact, that the building right in front, as you front on it on Livingston, on the main road right in front of the stadium, that little tiny structure is the leftover from Redbird Stadium.
Okay.
Which was there originally.
Right.
So you have sort of pieces of the past associated with baseball and a few other sports going all the way back almost a century at that location. And just ask any baseball fan why Cooper Stadium is important, and you'll get the answer to that. So in that sense, it is a cultural icon. And any transformative use of the site should take that into account. Does that mean you save every bit of the site? No, probably not. But I think it's important to save some pieces of it as we move along. And I think that's what part of the intriguing part of that auto plan was that it did retain important segments of the site.
There was a baseball park located where Penn State is. Or is it Pittsburgh, University of Pittsburgh? And someone was telling me about this campus where they actually have the original home base is under plexiglass.
Okay.
As a, that's all that's left.
Okay. Well.
That's not what you're talking about.
No. I think we're talking about doing a little bit more than that.
A little bit more than the structure.
Okay.
One building that's on the list this year, it was fascinating to me, is the Clinton Chapel. Tell us a little bit about where that's located and why it made the endangered list this year.
Okay. It's on the, well, I guess you'd say the near north side of Columbus. It's up on the Walhalla Ravine in the Clintonville area. The Clinton Chapel was originally established as a Methodist church in 1838. On that site, and that church is still there. It is the heart of what will later become the Southwick Funeral Home, which occupies the site now. That funeral home has recently closed, and the building has now become available. The building itself has extraordinary historic significance. It's one of the earliest standing structures in Franklin County. The Walhalla Ravine was used as an organization and, should we say, hiding place for folks on the Underground Railroad,
yeah.
And the church itself acted as a station on the Underground Railroad. And you can still, actually, if you take an overhead look at the building, you can make out exactly where the old chapel, the two-story building with the roof and so on,
yeah.
was located. It's
still there
with the rest of the home around it. And there is no definitive purpose put forward on what's going to be done with that site. And to bring public attention to this extraordinarily important site, we decided to move it up to the list.
As far as Columbus Landmarks goes, would you consider it a win if the Southwick Funeral Home was torn down and the chapel remained? I mean, how do you What looks like success in this case? Because I'm fascinated to see the chapel now.
Right.
It has bricks made from the materials from the quarry or from the ravine, I think.
Right.
And the beams in it were hewn from wood, trees that were found on the property.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, it's not.
Oh, it sounds amazing.
It's not that unusual. We got a lot of limestone, a lot of brick, and a lot of trees in this part of the world.
But so it's all inside of this other.
It's just that most of those buildings don't last and don't survive. I think one of the other things you need to be aware of from preservation viewpoint, professional preservation viewpoint, structures are essentially functions of and extensions of what they have become over time. So generally, preservationists are not of the view that you tear down everything that was put there since 1838 to return to look to just that 1838 building. You try to keep as much as you can because it tells the story of the site across its history.
Right.
Okay. So as a rule, we would say let's try to save that entire site if we can. Okay. Because it's a big site. Has ample parking already associated with it, and you could do a number of adaptive reuses and new structures, for that matter, on that site. And it also is sort of as you're coming down up High Street to that portion of the Walhalla Ravine, it is a very distinctive site.
Yeah.
It sort of jumps out at you as, well, oh, here are these guys.
Well, it's open and wide.
Yeah, right.
But who knew there was this old chapel in there?
And I think what you're going to find is whatever adaptive reuse or new development works on that site is going to have a spinoff effect down the High Street corridor into rest of Clintonville.
What do you mean by a spinoff effect?
Well, basically, if you come in with something new and interesting, no matter what it is and how good the design is, that's going to have an impact on the previous structures and their development in that particular corridor. A guy coming in to build another new building on another site is going to say, oh, well, we got this thing across the street. We got to take that into account with how we market our own site, what our new building is going to look like, that kind of thing. You see that kind of issue. It has nothing to do with the endangered list, but that's the kind of issue that you see in other parts of the city that are now experiencing relatively rapid development. What's your view of the High Street corridor through the short north? It has a certain height, a certain density, a certain compactness associated with it. What happens when you come along a street that has 5, 6, 7-story buildings, all nicely tight in a row, and you pop in a 30-story high-rise? Okay? What's that do to the way you begin to look at that street? What ends up happening, a lot of other guys start coming along and saying, well, we've got one 30-story high-rise, let's put in two or three more, and that kind of thing. My point from a preservation perspective is I'm not the short north in terms of the people who live there or the businesses that are there or the residents who live there. But the people who live there should be looking at those kind of structures as they're developing and say, is this what we want High Street to be? If that's what we want High Street to be, more power to you. But if you'd like it to be something else, hey, you know, keep an eye on what's happening on your block.
It's a slippery slope.
It could be, or it could be moving toward a whole new way of looking at that corridor that makes more sense. You know, what makes the most sense for the development of East Franklinton on the other side of the tracks?
Mm-hmm.
Now that we've got all these new things coming in on this side of the tracks, got the new Veterans Museum, the new underground parking garage for COSI, the proposed development of high rises right next to the railroad tracks. What's that do for the spaghetti warehouse, for example? You know, development doesn't stop because there's a railroad track.
Mm-hmm.
It just doesn't happen that way. Once you get that process rolling and moving, think about the new stuff that's being built on the south end of Franklinton,
yeah.
You know, out that corridor. What's that going to do to the corridor north of there? That's the kind of issues we think people should be thinking about and getting out there and letting their views known about. That's what we help do. And, you know, Landmarks, through all of its history, and I've been with them for quite a while, has worked on the assumption that if there is a neighborhood organization or a business organization or a civic organization that is leading the charge in one sense or another with regard to a proposed development, Landmarks will come in a secondary position behind those folks there on the ground, locally, right, in the front line. Now, occasionally, we will encounter either an endangered building or an endangered property or something we need to work with and help work on where there is no neighborhood group. There is no business association.
Okay.
That's when we come in first.
Okay.
And say, hey, this is something you ought to look at. Okay.
We're talking about Central Ohio and particularly Columbus's architectural history right now. My guest is Ed Lentz. He's executive director at Columbus Landmarks Foundation, which recently released its fourth annual endangered buildings list. If you have a question or comment about that going forward, we're going to talk about how to save those buildings, and we're going to talk about the business end of that, taking ownership, taking control, making your thoughts known about something, and also the practical, how actually do you preserve a building going up. So if you have questions about any of that, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the importance of historic structures in our community. The Columbus Landmarks Foundation has released its top 10 list of endangered buildings for 2017. It's the fourth year in a row they've done that. We now turn to the issue of upkeep of old buildings, what works, what doesn't, what's important to know. Still with us is the executive director of the Columbus Landmarks Foundation, Ed Lentz. And joining us is the department head for technical preservation services at the State Historic Preservation Office of Ohio, Mariangela Feaster. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Ann.
Also, real estate developer and president of Connect Realty and Mid-Ohio Contracting Services, Brad DeHaze. Welcome to the show, Brad.
Thank you, Ann. Glad to be here.
Brad, as a developer, what interests you about working with historic properties?
Well, I think historic buildings add a feature of character to a building as you're developing it. So it gives you bones to add to. I think we look at location is one of the primary vehicle of real estate. So we look at, where are the buildings located? What can we turn them into? What are the interests of the area? And when you have an existing structure, it gives you a starting point. The issue, though, with it is it's not a development that can be done in your office. So what happens is you have to put your feet to the pavement, spend a lot of time down at each building, And you know, there are a lot of emotional ties, especially in Columbus, you know, to some of these buildings that that are on these endangered lists. And I think, you know that you're going to get a lot of, community support and also community resistance. So you have to have more of a collaborative view when you're coming in, because it's not a, an empty piece of land. So when you're doing an adaptive reuse on a building, it is a community effort.
Why do you say a lot of emotional ties, especially in Columbus? What are you comparing Columbus to?
Well, I think the manufacturing history around Columbus, we're, Rust Belt, a Midwestern town. I think, our grandparents live here. Just in the last, 5-10 years, it seems like, we've really had this robust boom beginning downtown. So we're a lot of us that have been here in Central Ohio and in, out in the suburbs, we remember all these structures. As going downtown, you look at the buildings, you remember the ones that we've lost. And I think it's been more of a long-term view. When you see all the surface parking lots, there is a little bit of, I guess you can say, regret in all that asphalt that's downtown. And I think, it used to be great buildings there. And I think we look at it now with a different view as to how to prevent that from occurring.
Marie Angela, does Ohio have a good record when it comes to preservation? I read somewhere that it did. It's one of the best.
We actually are one of the best, and I'm very pleased to say that. And we historically have been. Initially, with the initiation of the program way back when, Governor Rhodes actually was a real proponent of history. And when this whole thing, when the 1966 National Historic Preservation Act was established, he was very interested in it. And we were really fortunate at the time to have Dan Porter, who was the director of what was then called the Ohio Historical Society, now the Ohio History Connection, who really took this under his wing and was a leading force. I mean, he was actually a founding member of the National Conference of State Historic Preservation Officers. And he really felt that if Ohio was going to do it, we were going to do it well. And just as an example, last fiscal year, Ohio had the most successful federal historic tax credit projects completed, that's completed projects, of any state in the union. And we are not the largest state. And historically,
it's a pretty big one, though.
And we have a lot of historic resources. But we've been in the top five in one of the categories for applications for the federal tax credit since my tenure, and I've been with the office for 30 years.
Brad, you're working on the Columbus Street Rail Project. I want to hear about that, but there are other things that you have completed, and most recently, the Grandview Cafe, which I just noticed has just opened up again.
Yeah, we're excited. So that the Grandview Cafe will celebrate its, 100th year anniversary, in 2027, if I'm not mistaken.
About 10 years.
Yeah. So we're not too far out. But the one of the things that we look at was just the community support. When we purchased it and we started to do the renovation, we would do all these different buildings around downtown, and people would keep asking, when's Grandview Cafe opening? When's Grandview Cafe opening? And we had this sign, and we put summer of 2016. And then when we opened the restaurant next door called Balboa, we were like, oh, we can't try to rush this through. So we went back to the drawing board. We saw the response of the area, and we knew that we needed to take more of a long-term approach on it. So last week was huge. We opened the windows along Grandview Avenue. We moved the kitchen upstairs, which is something that's not common to Columbus. But we've really seen a huge response from the community. I think on Saturday alone, we saw about 1,500 people walk through the door, which is a lot considering, it's kind of a metro burb over there.
How long was it closed for?
So it closed in October of 15.
So not that long.
About a year and a half.
Yeah. It seemed like longer, though.
It did.
For people who enjoyed going there, it seems like longer. And this is an example of, that local, that Ed Lentz was talking about earlier, that local interest, how important that is.
Yeah. And I think we take it seriously. Obviously, as a developer, a business owner, you want to get something opened as soon as possible. But the worst thing to do is swing and miss. So what happens is we usually try to take a long time with our planning because the unfortunate thing about buying a historic building is that you have to put the cash out there right off the bat. And then you have to, you know, have patient capital. You have to, you know, because you can't really tie things up in contract in urban markets and just expect the landlord to or the current owner to wait 6 months or a year for you to plan something. So you actually have to go out there and buy it. And then you have to look and see, is this something that we're going to be able to save? Is this something we're going to be able to remodel? And, you know, different projects have different endings. But Greenview Cafe, we think, was a success. We're really happy with the fact that we took the extra time, spent the extra money, and went out there and made it something special. And I think, you know, our goal is that it's going to be here, you know, another 50, 75 years.
You know, Marie Angela and Ed Lentz, you know, chime in, of course, but what's been lost that with our current sensibilities might still be here if we were looking at things 50 years ago the way we look at things today?
Well, the most important ones, the ones that make sort of are the relay cornerstones, if you will, of the preservation movement in Columbus, began in its most modern form with the loss of the Kelly Mansion, the house that saved Ohio. It had been pledged as a collateral to insure canal bonds to make sure that the canals got built. It was a classic Greek Revival mansion that stood right next to where Memorial Hall is on East Broad Street.
Okay.
It got torn down with a public protest about that removal, which led to the careful photo documentation of the site, each of the stones in the building being numbered. They were moved first to Franklin Park and then up by where the Ohio Historical Society was located, and eventually were moved up to Hale Farm in Cleveland, where they still sit to this day.
Unassembled.
Unassembled and waiting to come home. And what I've said in a number of pieces over the years is if you know anybody who has $5 million they don't know what to do with, I'd love to bring that house back and put it somewhere. That was a large public movement around that particular loss. The other one, of course, is the loss of Union Station in the fall of 1976. And a court order stopped the demolition, but only when one great arch was still left. That's the arch you still see down in McPherson Park.
In the
area right across from the arena.
Nationwide Arena District, right. Mm-hmm.
And out of that loss came the formation of the Columbus Landmarks Foundation a year later. Some of the folks associated with the Union Station arch and some new folks came together and said, you know, we need a permanent organization in this town that deals with historic preservation. So that was 40 years ago. We're celebrating our 40th anniversary this year. I've been around for most of them along the way. And the organization has grown significantly from being a small little 501c3 with a few members and no office to an organization now that has permanent office, permanent staff, 800-900 members, and I think some voice in these kind of matters. But that every city in Ohio has gone through that kind of transition. Cleveland itself did not have a preservation organization like ours until after World War II. Neither did Cincinnati. Neither did Dayton. They all do now. And that's part of the way preservation has become part of the fabric of our culture over the course of the last few decades.
You know, Maria Angela Feaster, when I hear about the story about the Ohio Theater and how they literally had the wrecking ball poised for the demolition and how people saved it at the last minute, we just can't do that anymore. That's passé at this point.
You're absolutely right. And I think of projects. I work with federal and state historic tax credit projects to try to give some assistance to people who want to do good rehab. And right now I have a current project, Levesque Tower. Can any of us imagine what Columbus would be without Levesque Tower? I don't think we can. You know, I have a project in Cleveland, Terminal Tower. Can anyone imagine what Cleveland would be without Terminal Tower? But it isn't just these iconic buildings that they are very important. They speak to what a community is. But, you know, we had a whole string of tax credit projects, historic tax credit projects on 4th Street. If you go up 4th Street towards campus and you look at those rehabs, those were all done with a federal and or state historic tax credits. And I would argue that those neighborhoods would look very different and they would be they wouldn't look as good if it were not for the fact that they had those rehabbed buildings. And the great thing—
You're talking about like the Jeffrey mining?
No, go on up. That wasn't a project of ours. Okay. They are the modest buildings, apartment buildings, townhouse buildings, if you go further up fourth. The thing about historic tax credit projects is that, they're for any type of building that's listed on the National Register. And the nice thing about the federal credits is they're kind of guaranteed. If you meet the IRS requirements, if you meet the National Park Service requirements, they're kind of cash in hand for doing good rehab of investment properties. And they're the biggest game in town to give a financial incentive to people who want to do that. But I could not agree with Ed more. The saving of these buildings actually speak to what a community is. You know, if you go into a town and everything looks the same, where are you? You don't know where you are. But for those buildings that tell you, okay, I'm in Columbus, I'm in Cleveland, I'm in Dayton, or I'm in Worcester, or I'm in Maslin, or wherever you are, it's the historic buildings that really tell you where you are.
Brad DeHaze, you've availed yourself of tax credits like this? You've participated in those kind of programs?
Yes, I have, I think, four tax credit projects going right now. And I do think Mary Angela and her team do a phenomenal job by comparison to other states. I think that the tax credit program, the way it is right now, is one of the most, I guess you'd say, accountable programs that I've ever seen. And just as an example, I did the Ohio Farm Bureau offices at 620, 630 East Broad Street, which is where Nationwide was founded. And it had the Huntington Mansion is on the same property, and the Roger Sullivan Mansion. So two historic mansions with an annex out back. We did state and federal historic tax credits. We finished that project 2 years ago. However, there was an issue with the windows. They weren't built exactly to spec. So the state has not had to release any money on that project until that window issue is remedied. And we're working through that right now. Mm-hmm. So on all these projects, we really have to go to another level of renovation. And I think what that does is if you want to go and try to do tax credit development, you have to be prepared to take a full scope at your rehab. Mm-hmm. I think that's really important with these buildings because in Central Ohio we have a lot of masonry buildings, brick, concrete web structure. So a lot of them before steel high rises were put together, and it's just there's a lot of care that needs taken. And I with regards to the state tax credit, there's a lot of duplicated resources to the federal tax credit program. So I know last year, they were talking about making the state tax credit program a grant, and that really would have changed the entire dynamic. And I think, there was a huge rally by a lot of tax credit developers, historians, accountants, architects, all the people with a vested interest. And I think what is said was, there are a lot of jobs created with these projects. And if the federal tax credit program operates this way, it only makes sense to get a little bit of redundancy in your resources by having the state program reciprocate that.
We're going to continue our conversation about historic preservation in Columbus, Central Ohio, and the rest of the state. You just heard from Brad DeHaze. He's a real estate developer and president of Connect Realty and Mid-Ohio Contracting Services. Also with us, Mary Angela Feaster. She's department head for technical preservation services at the State Historic Preservation Office of Ohio. And also with us, Ed Lenz, executive director of Columbus Landmarks Foundation. We'll get to these calls waiting for us. If you have an email you want to send, you can send it to allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about protecting historic buildings that make up our heritage. Restoring and rehabilitating older buildings can be not only daunting, but also very expensive. There are tax, tax incentives aimed at historic preservation. Ohio is right now first in the country for completed projects that make use of a federal historic preservation tax credit. Still with us is Executive Director of the Columbus Landmarks Foundation, Ed Lentz, also real estate developer Brad DeHays, and Department Head for Technical Preservation Services at the State Historic Preservation Office of Ohio, Mary Angela Feaster. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Getting back to the Union Station issue, that was on the National Register of Historic Places. So just getting on that register doesn't matter?
Well, I wouldn't say it doesn't matter, but it is not an absolute protection against demolition. It doesn't really say just by being on the National Register, it's a recognition of the historic importance of the building. Now, a whole different thing comes into play that Angela can talk about more as well, that if there is a federal undertaking involved with a National Register site, so you want to blow a train track through or something along that line, then a whole new set of procedures come into play. This is called Section 106. And again, the State Preservation Office is associated with that sort of thing in terms of a federal undertaking. But if there's no federal undertaking, if you have a building on the National Register of Historic Places and you decide you want to tear it down and put a McDonald's in there, there's nothing to keep you from doing it, pure and simple.
Ryan in Lewisburg, you're on the air. Hi, Ryan.
Hi. Awesome topic. There are a couple of buildings by a spaghetti warehouse that I know of that might be something happening to them soon. I was wondering, is there anything that, like, the public can do above the owner to maybe try to get it preserved?
You mean to go over the owner's head, you mean?
Yeah.
You're talking about that East Broad Street near Spaghetti Warehouse area, Mary Angela?
Yeah, the tattoo shop and the Harley-Davidson shop.
So Ed is absolutely right. An owner of a private property that is not going to do anything federally with it can really do anything they want with their property. However, what we have at the State Historic Preservation Office at the Ohio History Connection are resources. You know, we can talk with the applicant. Hey, if you want to rehab your building, if you want to do it according to a set of standards, we can help you with that. And everything that we do is, you know, free. We advise people all the time. And, you know, why not take advantage if you do state and federal tax credits of up to a potential of 45% credit off the cost of your rehabilitation. And Brad is absolutely right. Most of our projects do federal and state tax credits because it really doesn't make sense not to. If you're listed on the National Register of Historic Places and you're going to do a good rehab project and it's an income-producing property, why not take advantage of both credits?
Mm-hmm. Most people do both.
98% in Ohio do.
But can you go over the head of a private owner?
Can't.
You can't.
No.
Okay.
Not at the state level. You can't.
Okay, Ryan. Thanks for that call. Blake and Bexley are on the air. Hi, Blake.
Hi. How's it going?
Good.
So I'm curious to know. I think Bexley is a pretty unique community in the sense that it is, at least it's tried to be zoned or tried to be considered a historic district on itself. And I think that comes as, like, much to the chagrin and sort of disadvantage of the surrounding communities, sort of Whitehall living scenarios.
Why is that?
I think that I think the borderlines are very, very clear. The income levels and the sort of development levels, there's a very apparent distinction. And I was wondering if the sort of the role of preservation and rehabilitation had anything in mind to sort of rehabilitate or revitalize those communities.
In other words, extend the impact beyond that. Mary Angela?
Oh, my gosh, absolutely. So I'm going to take Cincinnati as an example. Over the Rhine, the Over the Rhine Historic District of Cincinnati, those were very modest buildings as they were constructed, and we do a huge number of federal and state tax credit projects there, many of which, I might add, are low-income housing tax tax credit projects as well. So there's not a displacement of the people who want to live there. In Bexley, we just wrapped a project with the Drexel Theater. Well, it's because they, you know, were very forward thinking. They got the building listed on the National Register for National Register of Historic Places and pursued the credits. Anyone can do that. Anyone that has a district or building that they think might be potentially eligible for the National Register can contact our office. It's called the National Register questionnaire process. It's very simple, straightforward, and they will tell you. Our staff will tell you if you have potential.
Is this what Bexley is to Whitehall, a little bit of like what German Village is to the Marion Village? It was outside of German Village. It's really only been in the last 20 or 25 years that Marion Village has started to change.
You know, I've never thought of it that way. And I've lived in this community, as I said. I graduated from Capital and from my master's work is at Ohio State. So I've been here a very long time and I've never thought of it that way. It's just if you have a historic district, if you have a historic building, no matter where you are, you have the potential of working with us and getting it listed.
I think the important thing to understand is that each city, community in Ohio structures its neighborhood governance in different ways. And if you have an issue in Columbus, there is a whole system of area commissions that have been set up as advisory to the city. And in addition to the area commissions, which you can find, by the way, at columbus.gov, the website for the city of Columbus, and if you have an issue in an area that has an area commission and you're living in that area, go to the area commission and explain your concern. In addition, there are 200 and some neighborhoods around Columbus. We've only covered a few of them on Columbus neighborhoods. We have a lot more to cover.
That's for sure.
But there are also civic and neighborhood organizations, even in the areas outside the area commissions. So it's important wherever you're living in Central Ohio, if you have an issue associated with where you live, where you work, where you play, take a look at who you can go to talk with and share those concerns.
You know, Brad DeHaes, what Blake and Bexley is talking about, though, I know what he's talking about. There is a demarcation. You can tell where Bexley drops off and Whitehall picks up. But there are a lot of cool things in Whitehall to save, too.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you look at when you change from one municipality to another, Whitehall Main Street is its core.
Yeah.
So you have the economic anchor of Capital University there. And you have when you look at it, when you're driving down the street, obviously you have the beautiful boulevard they put in. But you have that zero lot line setback. And that brings all the buildings up to the sidewalk level and makes that walkable community feel.
Right.
Where if you had, as soon as you crossed into Whitehall on Main Street, if you had maybe some of the buildings that – I'm going to throw this out. I think they're on Yearling. Some of those buildings that are more towards Whitehall's core, if those were right there – then, yeah, I think you would have more of a seamless transition. But as soon as you cross the line, you have buildings that were built in the 1950s and 60s, and your parking lot is in front of your structure.
Mm-hmm.
And it just creates a different feel because of the different location that you are in the municipality, where I think German Village to Marion Village is a little bit more seamless because your setbacks, your lot lines, even
we're
though they're
all
just,
the same, right?
Yeah, and there's even a Hungarian village a little further south. And I think it's more so about the age of the structures, and you sprinkle in a few of those buildings
but
the times.
But the character, essential character, doesn't change that much.
Exactly.
Yeah,
I think
the
other kind of things you have to think about when you're looking at these areas is what are the anchors that hold the community together.
Mm-hmm.
You got the Defense Supply Center over on the far east side of Whitehall, which is a significant institution in that general area. And then coming back over toward Capital University, the key thing to remember is that Main Street was the national road,
right.
U.S. Route 40. And that whole area has been built, torn down, rebuilt, torn down at least three times over the course of the last 130 years or so. Certain areas missed the teardown. Bexley is one of them. But that's part of the major difference you got to understand. You got to know the background before you can move forward. That's part of what we do. That's why it's called historic preservation.
And I think zoning is an issue. I mean, I think, you're talking about walkable communities and where development's going. In these urban districts, You know, the setbacks are critical. Where do you put your parking is critical. And we're starting to see a lot more zero setback zoning. I think Columbus did a great job downtown in the downtown district, you know, eliminating the height. You know, it's unlimited height anywhere, zero setback. I mean, it's the most permissive zoning you could have. And that's what we're seeing the boom come from. And it's amazing that we're actually seeing buildings being saved in that district, because you would think unlimited height, zero setback, you know, who would want to keep a two-story building? But there, we're seeing people that actually, you know, take a vested interest in them and put the money into them just to salvage it for the future.
Blake in Bexley, thanks for that call. Ken in Upper Arlington, you're on the air. Hi, Ken. Hello, Ken. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi.
Can you hear me? I'm sorry.
That's
Hi.
Okay.
I'm in a bad connection area. Thanks
okay.
for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to take this opportunity to say how much I, over the years, have admired Mr. Lentz's passion for history, especially regional and local history. I've enjoyed your writings and your advocacy for restoring. I wish you were more of a prominent voice when we lost Union Station. I'd love to see Amtrak come back to this area. But again, my primary purpose of my call was to thank Mr. Lentz for his dedication and love of what he professes.
Thank you,
Ken. All.
Yeah.
Thank you as well.
Thank you, Ken. I was just looking. I have a copy of an old Columbus Chamber of Commerce, where to find what you want and where to find it book from 1911. And it has all of the schedules for the train arrivals and departures. And it's just bizarre to think about how busy that place must have been and what a focal point Union Station must have been for the city back in the day. Because in 1911, it was just crazy how busy it was.
Yeah.
So
Union Station was the place to be if you wanted to go anywhere. Because right. in an era before regularized air transportation, and when highways basically could get you up to 35 to 40 miles an hour on a good day, if you really wanted to get someplace fast, you could go on the interurban for a long time and go up and take a 90-mile-an-hour train up to Delaware or over to Newark. But most people would take the regular train. A little cheaper, a little slower, but still the place to be.
Brad DeHays, just going forward, when something like the Grandview Cafe reopens, Ed Lent said earlier that there is a domino effect that everyone else in the area starts to look around and go, well, that kind of changes maybe what we were going to do down the street or that kind of a thing. Has that been your experience?
Yeah, I think we call that urban infill.
Okay.
So, you know, a lot of more so it takes place, you know, downtown, but in the suburban markets, maybe if you have vacant land or other structures around it, I think people have a little bit more willingness to speculate. You know, so for instance, you know, a few years ago, we purchased the Trolley Barn project, which is the municipal street rail over on the east side of Columbus. And we've been planning a development there for a few years, and you know, the wheels have been on and it's come off and been back on again. So we're excited about it. But that market has continued to move since we bought it. People around there have started to purchase properties. The apartment complex next door was purchased by Ohio Cap. And we look at that as kind of a little bit of boost to confidence. You know, people, there's a lot of idle money out there. Hmm. And people are looking to put it into structures, into real estate. They're very pro-Columbus. And I think, Grandview Cafe, we were just tacking on the great things that, you know, Cameron Mitchell did at the Avenue and, you know, that whole strip of the bank block in Grandview. So I wouldn't say that we were anything with regards to being a trendsetter over there, but we were happy to kind of join it. And I think that Grandview Avenue strip going all the way to 5th could be a very powerful one if it's developed properly.
Brad DeHays, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Brad DeHaze, real estate developer and president of Connect Realty and Mid-Ohio Contracting Services. And Mary Angela Feaster, thanks to you as well. Appreciate your time today.
I appreciate you having us on.
Mary Angela Feaster is the department head for technical preservation services at the State Historic Preservation Office of Ohio. And Ed Lentz, as always, great to have you back. Thank you so much for your time.
Always a pleasure, man.
Ed Lentz, executive director at the Columbus Landmarks Foundation. Thanks a lot for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.